Okay, well, welcome to this session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. As you know, this is being held through remote technology. And for the clarity of the record, because we will be providing an audio recording of this record available to the public after the hearing, please identify yourself as you start your argument. If there are any technical difficulties at any point, just let us know and we will get that corrected. And with that, we have only one case on our calendar this morning. The other case was resolved and dismissed. So with that, Marshall, do you want to call our first, our only case?
Yes. Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Ross, and Judge Gaitis. The Honorable Susan L. Siegel presiding. And we are calling case A210645 in the matter of the civil commitment of Edward Eugene Dooley.
Great. And with that, as you both know, each side has 15 minutes. And Mr. Mack, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And so with that, Mr. Mack, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. John Mack for Appellant Dooley. I'm going to concentrate on the issue of the provisional discharge, because in order to obtain a provisional discharge, a applicant must only present a prima facie case. Therefore, the panel erred in failing to find he made a prima facie case and ending the case at the end of the petitioner's presentation. The question is then, did Mr. Dooley present a prima facie case with respect to a provisional discharge? And there is evidence of it. First, of course, Mr. Dooley testified at some length about the progress he'd made, the fact that he was no longer dangerous, the fact that he had improved his mental standing considerably since 2013 when he was committed.
Mr. Mack, how does that testimony provide a prima facie case in light of Poole, which stands for the proposition that the committed person's own testimony, at least in the context of testimony that's contradicted by the documentary evidence submitted, is not sufficient to make a prima facie case?
Let me say two things about that. First, I don't really think that Poole stands for the proposition that a committed person has to have extrinsic evidence in addition to his own testimony. Poole is an odd case because Poole, in this case, stated that he wasn't amenable to treatment. And here's what the Supreme Court said. Because the crux of Poole's claim that he is not a danger to the public is his own otherwise unsupported reading of those assessments and is contrary to his own expert reading of those assessments, his argument is that his own otherwise uncorroborated assertions entitle him to a second phase evidentiary hearing. I submit that that indicates that the court found against Poole because Poole not only was uncorroborated, but was contradicted by his testimony and by other testimony, and because he didn't explain away the contradictions in his own testimony.
Well, I understand that's your position, but that's not the actual holding of the case. The syllabus points pretty clear that conclusory or otherwise unsupported assertions by the committed person doesn't establish a prima facie case, but even accepting your proposition that that only applies, that standard only applies when the testimony is contradicted by documentary evidence. In this case, we have documentary evidence submitted by your client, which does contradict his assertion that he's progressing and your argument that he's progressing when the professional said he is in fact regressing.
Two things about that. First, he did present some extrinsic evidence. For example, the SRB found that not only did he qualify for community preparation services, but they did not think that he was any more a danger to the public if he were to take those to take the opportunity to obtain community preparation services.
Let me pause you there before you mention any other evidence. I didn't see any citation in your brief, and it doesn't seem intuitive to me that the SRB's finding is evidence. It's a recommendation. It's reviewed de novo. Is there case law that supports the proposition that an SRB, that recommendation is itself evidence?
I'm not sure that the recommendation is, but the determination, which cites to the evidence, would seem to be evidence in the CAP hearing.
Have you found any case law that supports that proposition?
I haven't found any case law one way or another as to how you deal with SRB findings with respect to the CAP, but it does seem to me that the SRB determinations may not be evidence, but the findings that they make in the SRB should be, yes, because that's before the
and does it matter whether or not there was an updated record before the that occurred after the findings? Doesn't that bear?
No, not with respect to prima facie findings, because if all you have to do is make a prima facie case, then those subsequent findings are evidence that should have been brought to the panel's attention by the commissioner and were. And that would relate to the final decision of the CAP panel, but not to the determination that appellant has not made a prima facie case.
So, Mr. Mack, if I could, so on the provisional discharge prong, one of the two factors is whether there's no longer a need for treatment and supervision. And it seems like there's very little, if any, evidence on that point actually presented by your client in the first phase of the hearing. And so what should we be looking at now for, I mean, what is, and I know that he had fives and, you know, then at the time of the SRB hearing and was doing satisfactorily on a number of things, but I don't think any place that says that there's no longer a need for treatment, or am I missing something?
Well, I think that you're missing something that is essential here. Looking through the findings, including the negative materials submitted by Mr. Schweik, there is very little, if any, that goes to the question of whether he's dangerous or whether he poses a risk to the public. And I think that in order to deny him a provisional discharge, it is insufficient to say that there has to be a determination that there's no need for treatment. Suppose that my client were not I won't use the word incarcerated, but at least held at MSOP, and this had been an ordinary commitment, then you wouldn't have to say in order to have a release that he would have to show that he no longer needs treatment. Why should MSOP be any different if the issue is public safety? The only reason my client and any other person so situated is held at MSOP is that they're deemed to be potentially dangerous to the public. In the absence of such a finding, and the absence of a finding of further dangerousness, my client shouldn't be denied a provisional discharge. Now, I briefly raised an issue that is not directly before this court, and I acknowledge it, but I wanted to bring it up because this is going to make a fair amount of difference if this goes anywhere beyond the Court of Appeals. And that's the issue of whether or not what Mr. Dooley is undergoing is punishment. Judge Frank is due to have his decision by the end of September. Again, I'm not saying that this is directly relevant, but I wanted to bring it up so I'm not told later by some court that I should have brought it up earlier.
Well, that maybe this court should be the one that's raising the question of whether you should have brought it up earlier. I'm glad that you acknowledge in your brief that you didn't raise this below, but you're raising the constitutional question for the first time on appeal. And I've got a couple of problems with that, and you can just disabuse me of my concerns. One is that you cite the Karstens case as if it's new law, and you say that because of you didn't know about Karstens before, we should consider, or we have grounds to consider your constitutional argument, even though it's brand new in this court. And I guess my problem with that, and you can again address it, is I don't know, you didn't cite any rule of law that says that there's some exception to the forfeiture doctrine, that you can raise an issue if some case later on shows up. That's one concern I've got. Another concern is that I don't think the Eighth Circuit decision is any more binding on this court than any other federal decision other than the United States Supreme Court. But even if that were so, even except for those things, when I read Karstens itself cites, it's an Eighth Circuit decision in 2012, the Ballew decision. And it says that, and I'll quote here, "We applied the Bell standard to a claim brought by an individual who alleged that the IMSOB's practice of double bunking was punitive." So I'm not even sure that Karstens is supposedly new law on this subject when the Eighth Circuit itself says, we've already applied this Bell standard in a previous IMSOB case. Can you address those issues?
Well, for one thing, I'm not sure that Karstens is going to be the law after Judge Frank makes his determination. Secondly, it seems to me, and I acknowledge that this court is extremely unlikely to determine the constitutional issue because I didn't have an opportunity to raise it below, and I didn't have that opportunity because that case hadn't come down. But I do think that the court should have in the back of its mind when it's determining the issue of whether he should have a provisional discharge, that some of the issues raised by the government in this case are under review.
Well, that was the heart of my question, though, was that you say that you weren't aware of Karstens. You didn't know this standard until the Karstens decision came down.
Right.
But Karstens itself relies upon the Ballew decision from 2012 and then applies the Bell standard that you say you didn't know about. So why do you say that Karstens is a new standard when the Eighth Circuit relied upon a 2012 decision of the Eighth Circuit for its holding in Karstens? It doesn't seem to be new at all to me.
I guess my answer to that is because we don't really know what Karstens says until we know what Judge Frank is going to say. I want to go back to what I think is a real issue here because I raised the constitutional point only tangentially. And that's that my client has a right to have the court consider everything he said. Now, even if Poole is the law, I have, and I cite some evidence outside of the testimony of my client himself, my client's testimony should not have been disregarded. The court should not have said, well, we have the right to ignore his own statements because of Poole. No, it doesn't. If in accordance with whatever evidence he has also presented, and he has presented those because he has shown progress, though he may have regressed in the last 6 months or so, the showing of progress in addition to his testimony allows his testimony to be taken as true, and at least as to the factual claims. And the factual claims in this case indicate that he is not a danger to the public, that he would be able to operate with treatment, that he is cooperating largely with treatment, and that therefore he should be given a provisional discharge.
I want to be clear. I don't think I understand. Maybe you can clarify for me. Are you suggesting that the updated report is not something that we ought to consider in our de novo review, and that the appeal panel also should not have considered the updated report as it regards the prima facie case?
Not for the purposes of a prima facie case. Obviously, it could consider it for the purpose of a transfer because there are all the evidences before it, but it should not have considered it for the purpose of seeing whether my client has made a prima facie case. Because a prima facie case simply means what evidence has been brought forward by the party bringing it forward. And the court is not to consider the negative evidence that would refute it. At least
isn't your client, wasn't it your client who presented the updated report?
Yeah, and because even the updated report indicates that before his last 6 months, he had been making progress. They had certainly been making progress considerably since 2013.
So your position is that the appeal panel could consider the updated report, but only to the extent that it doesn't include the current circumstances at the time of the appeal panel's review?
For the purposes of provisional discharge only. I think it's a somewhat strange law, but as I understand the law, is that for purposes of provisional discharge, all the appellant has to do is make a prima facie case, whereas for the purposes of transfer, he has to prove his case. I find that very odd, but I think it's the law.
I think you're right on the law. So what you're suggesting is that when he presented when your client presented the update, it was to be applied only to the question of the preponderance of the evidence in the transfer, but not the prima facie case. I'm sorry, it only presented for the preponderance of the evidence standard, not for the prima facie case standard.
Right.
Was that clear?
Questions. I think I've run out of time.
Was that clearly presented below, that it was only being offered for one purpose, not the other?
No, I just offered it, but I suppose I have the right to argue from anything that's in it.
All right. And Mr. Mack, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Schweik, when you're ready, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court, counsel. Leonard Schweik, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. The Commissioner's argument in this case is pretty straightforward. With regard to provisional discharge, as has been already noted, the only testimony or evidence that was submitted to the panel on provisional discharge in support of provisional discharge was the client or Mr. Dooley's own testimony. And the court is correct that under Poole, that standing alone is insufficient to make out a prima facie case.
Just to be clear, when I know that's what the Poole court said, but we read a holding in the context of the facts. And in Poole, this court emphasized it with using italics, the finding in the report that he, I think was, that he must not be released, that he, I'll quote the actual language here because I thought it was significant when I read it, that he cannot be transferred to a less secure facility. So it was in the context of a directly contrary statement to the testimony, to the committed person's testimony, that this court said, well, you can't just offer your own testimony up. In that case, the testimony was clearly contradicted. Do you agree that we have to read Poole in the context of the additional testimony, additional evidence that was provided?
In light of the court's indication that the evidence was uncorroborated, I believe that's a fair reading. But in this case, there was contradictory evidence submitted by the appellant. For example, the April 2020 sexual violence risk assessment directly contradicted his testimony with regard to provisional discharge. And Dr. Lynn indicated in that report, and again, this is the appellant's evidence, that Mr. Dooley does not meet the criteria for full discharge at this time. And that was not the only piece of evidence that contradicted the appellant's testimony. The appellant had also put in two quarterly reports with respect to his treatment. In the October 2020 quarterly report, which was the appellant's Exhibit 104, there the treatment team indicated that Mr. Dooley is not addressing issues with regard to sexuality or deviance during this review period. He does not show the capability to process sexual offending behaviors or his group. that he's not addressing underlying issues impacting the present functioning or past harm to others. He's not processing how his mental health diagnosis impacts his life or responsibility in treatment. So that testimony alone through the quarterly reports that he submitted directly contradicts his testimony that he is not in need of any treatment or ongoing treatment.
Do you agree with Mr. Mack that the updated report of Dr. Is it Gierach? I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. But do you agree that the updated report can only be considered by this court and the appeal panel for the purpose of applying it to the preponderance of the evidence test, but not as applied to the prima facie case standard test?
Your Honor referred to Dr. Gierach's report, which was the court-appointed examiner. I do agree that that report can only be considered in the context of the petition for transfer. However, the petitioner, or Mr. Dooley, submitted in his case in chief the quarterly treatment reports that I just referenced, and also the April 2020 SVRA that I had mentioned. That was his evidence, his exhibits. There's no indication in the transcript that he made any distinction as to what he was putting the evidence in for or for what reason. And
even if he doesn't make the distinction, if we're reviewing whether, well, maybe I could just ask you directly, are we reviewing the evidence as it was presented to the SRB? Or to
No? No, I didn't mean to interrupt, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
On the issue of provisional discharge, when a case is dismissed pursuant to Rule 41.02B, the Court of Appeals on that issue does a de novo review. So the court can consider the documents that the appellant had submitted on the issue of provisional discharge. My reading of the case law is the court, neither the CAB panel nor the appellate court should consider evidence that was submitted by the commissioner on the issue of transfer only when looking at the provisional discharge issue. But regardless of the reports that the petitioner put into evidence, the petitioner also in his own testimony contradicted his testimony in terms of his part.
The updated report was presented by the petitioner.
Correct.
And so
the SVRA update, not Dr. Gierach's update.
Also, Dr. Gierach's update was presented by the state, not by.
Correct, on the issue of transfer only. The report that
I thought
was
referenced. I misunderstood that. I thought Mr. Mack was acknowledging that that updated report of Dr. Gierach was presented by his client.
Yeah, I think the confusion comes in because both the April 2020 sexual violence risk assessment is labeled as an update, and it's indicated on page 7 of our brief, and Dr. Gierach's January 2021 report is also an update. With regard to provisional discharge, the only expert report that we've referenced on that issue is the April 2020 SVRA.
Thank you.
Mr. Schweik, just so I'm clear, your position is anything that was submitted by Mr. Mack in this case in support of a prima facie case, whether it's supportive of provisional discharge or not, is fair game for this court to consider. We can't consider evidence that the commission presented, but anything presented by Mr. Dooley and his attorney is fair game. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor, with regard to provisional discharge. And then for the same reasons that the provisional discharge petition was properly dismissed by the Court of Appeals panel. likewise transfer, which is, of course, a different standard, and that's a preponderance of the evidence standard where the CAP panel can weigh and evidence and that type of thing. But again, the evidence that was before the panel included the petitioner's, or excuse me, Mr. Dooley's testimony, but all of the documentary evidence contradicted his testimony with regard to transfer.
Well, Mr. For example, Schweik, is it your argument then that the only way to get to the merits on a provisional discharge petition is for appellant to have their own expert then? I mean, at the time of the SRB hearing, everything was pointing towards maybe not provisional discharge, but the SRB found transfer was appropriate. Mr. Dooley apparently had trouble with one roommate, which I know kids in college can have problems with roommates, let alone individuals committed to the MSOP program. So do they need to get their own expert? Is that your argument? That's the only way to overcome, unless there's unanimous agreement among the in-house professionals, that provisional discharge is appropriate.
With regard to provisional discharge, the petitioner has the burden of producing a prima facie case. So it's incumbent upon the petitioner to make out that prima facie case, or what's referred to as the burden of production. That can be done in a number of ways that I've seen in the case law. For example, that there was corroborating evidence from people that treated a client that aren't the experts rendering an opinion as to provisional discharge, but for example, their own clinicians, that type of thing. That's evidence that has been put in. So, and I do know that the, according to the appellate decisions, that the petitioner can rely on a number of different pieces of evidence. But no, it's not our position that they need an expert to say that he's entitled to provisional discharge. But in this case, there's no evidence indicating that he's entitled to provisional discharge, because what happened since in the 10 months from the SRB hearing to the CAP hearing, his own treatment notes that he submitted as evidence show that he had regressed substantially in treatment. His own testimony, he admitted that he had 6 behavioral expectation reports during that 10-month period before the CAP panel. So then Mr. Dooley puts in the April 2020 SVRA, which directly contradicts his claim in this case that he is entitled to provisional discharge, as does the quarterly reports that he put into evidence, indicates that his treatment had not continued to improve during those 2 months, as indicated in the October 2020 report.
Mr. Mack is arguing, I think here's the fundamental disconnect as I see it. Mr. Mack is arguing that our focus is on whether there was sufficient production of evidence to the SRB. And your position is that the question is, was there sufficient evidence presented to the appeal panel?
Correct, because the Court of Appeals panel reviews the case and considers the case de novo, and that's indicated by statute.
But is it, when you say considered de novo, is it as of the evidence presented to the Court of Appeals panel, or is it de novo review of the SRB recommendation? And if you could support your answer with either statutory or case law support.
We've cited the statute in our brief, and the statute, I believe, is
'de novo review. But I want to get a sense of, is there language there that says the de novo review is based upon evidence at the Court of Appeals panel, or the appeal panel, or is it based upon evidence presented at the SRB? What's your best support for the distinction that you're asking us to make?
it's the evidence that's presented to the Court of Appeals panel, for example.
Right, based upon what case law and what language in the statute?
The de novo review and the fact that...
So it's just that phrase, you think it's just that phrase, de novo review, that gets us the evidence that's presented later on. Now, Mr. Mack is saying he has a right to present for his client at that CAP the evidence that should be considered by a preponderance of the evidence. And so it's up to the CAP to make a distinction as to what evidence applies to the review of the SRB decision and the CAP determination about preponderance of the evidence.
Well, the preponderance of the evidence would only apply to the issue of transfer, because right. that's the standard on that. The provisional discharge, that's where he would have to make out a prima facie case. And as the pool court indicated, his testimony standing alone, that's uncorroborated, is not sufficient to make out a prima facie case. And not only is his testimony not corroborated, it's actually contradicted by the evidence and the records he put into evidence. So now, there just to clarify one thing, that with regard to the conditions of a provisional discharge, the statute is clear that the Court of Appeals panel can only consider evidence that was submitted to the SRB as to the terms and conditions of a release on a provisional discharge or full discharge. The statute does make that distinction, but with regard to evidence, for example, the October 2020 quarterly treatment report was evidence that could not have been submitted to the SRB because the SRB hearing occurred 10 months prior to the Court of Appeals panel, but yet that evidence from the October 2020 quarterly report submitted by the petitioner was, the CAP panel was able to consider that evidence, even though it had not been submitted to the SRB. And for example, to underscore that, when the court appoints an examiner, it's an independent examiner, that occurs after the SRB panel. So then on the issue of transfer, for example, that's evidence that's post-SRB that could be considered by the panel on the issue of transfer only in the event that the petitioner had not submitted in their case in chief. And I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Mack, go ahead.
Two brief issues, one of which is semi-procedural. Counsel pointed out that I did not make the distinction between the use of evidence at the CAP hearing between the effect of the evidence with regard to the transfer and the effect of the evidence with respect to provisional discharge. The problem I have with that is that the CAP panel came back with its ruling immediately after I had rested, rather than giving me a chance to brief the issue or even argue the issue with respect to that distinction. Obviously, that is a fairly technical issue, as we've seen today. And
well, but if you're raising that as a procedural concern, I don't think that you've presented that as a basis for reversal in your brief.
No, it isn't. But one of the things, of course, that the court should be aware of in this case is I was unable to do a reply brief like I usually do because I was down with COVID. I think it's important for this court to look at all the evidence because many of those reports do contain negative determinations, but they contain affirmative ones too. For example, look at the checklists, which show reasonable progress. They don't show substantial regress, and that should be considered as one of the bases which is corroborating my client's testimony, particularly to the effect that there's very little, if anything, in those reports showing risk to the public in allowing him to have a provisional discharge. Thank you.
I just, you have a little bit of time left. Let me see if I can throw one more question out for you. in the event that you would succeed on the question of transfer, and so the we said the prima facie case was met, then it just goes back for more hearing. And then, am I correct that what happens then is you do have the evidence of the updated report by Dr. Gerach presented, and the panel does consider that evidence. Am I correct that that would be the procedural circumstance?
Yes, if the court thinks my client has made out a prima facie case, then the court could look at all the evidence on the issue, but only after the court makes a determination that he made a prima facie case.
Thank you.
And just to be clear, you put in, you rested on the transfer issue, correct? So that you put in all evidence you wanted to submit on the transfer issue.
Yes.
Okay, all right. That's very helpful. Okay, anything further, Mr. Mack, or?
No, Your Honor, I'm almost out of time.
All right, and any other questions from the panel? All right, well, thank you both so much for your arguments and your briefing. The case is now submitted, and we will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. And we now stand adjourned. So thank you much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.